If you want to ride roughshod over everybody and you've got the strongest energy, you're going to ride roughshod. But if you come with a heart of service and you come with an expectation of we're all in this together and you have the strongest energy, then everybody else rises to that challenge, to that level, and you see a completely different result. And I really believe the first time I heard the strongest energy wins, I was like, yeah, whatever. That's more of that woo-woo stuff. But I've watched it play out time and time and time again in so many environments, and it's true, the strongest energy wins.
Welcome to Gratitude Geek, the relationship marketing podcast for micropreneurs building genuine, lasting relationships with clients, colleagues, and community. I'm your host, Candace Ridardi, and today I'm joined by business growth consultant, Lisa Robin Young. Lisa did not wait to get discovered. She is an award-winning speaker, best-selling author, and accomplished musician with multiple albums to her credit. Lisa's been featured on Disney Plus, is the host of Creative Freedom, and helps undervalued unicorns get seen, get paid, and leave their mark on the world. Lisa believes that the best way to be truly successful in life and business is to be yourself, warts, sparkles, and all. So you can own your own dreams without selling your soul. Lisa founded ARC Entertainment Media, a business growth consultancy for out-of-the-box entrepreneurs that want to have a profitable, sustainable business doing what they love. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you for having me. I've been counting down the days to this interview, so I'm looking forward to it.
We had a really fun chat several months ago, and
yeah,
this is going to be part two. So y'all didn't get to hear the first part of the conversation. Okay, so for the audience, tell us your story. How did you get to where you are today? I want to hear about the Disney Plus. I want to hear it all. Give me the scoop.
Gosh, well, I mean, that by itself would probably take the whole hour. But long story short, I've been a performing artist my entire life. Like when I was 3 years old, I was wrangling up the neighbor kids and charging them a nickel to, watch me sing and dance like Shirley Temple or something. And so from there, I was raised in a welfare family where wanting to be a rock star was like, that's nice, dear, but you really need to have a fallback plan. So I spent a lot of my life building my fallback plan, and in the process became a business coach, found online marketing, got involved in that. Ooh, it's been 30 years now that I've been in the online world. And then from there, my audience has kind of shifted several times, but where I've landed at this point is micro entrepreneurs, solopreneurs who know that they want to have the impact and the reach of a celebrity in their space, right? They want to make that kind of a difference in the world. And so I spend a lot of time working with my clients to help them do just that. And it's been a wonderful journey. In the process, on the other side of my life, because I like to say, I have my feet in two worlds, right? So performing artist, business coach. On the performing artist side of things, back in 2019, I think it was, we got asked to, me and my high school chums auditioned for and got accepted into the Disney Plus show Encore, where they bring all of these high school students back to reunite them to remount their high school musical. Our musical was The Sound of Music, and we had to remount the show in 5 days. So it was grueling, but it was so fun. It was just really a joy and a delight to see all those people and be back in that again. So, and along the way, I've written books and music and recorded albums and all of that good stuff. So I'm one of those people who's like, if it's something that's on your heart to do, find a way to do it, right? Whatever your capacity constraints are, find a way to do the things that fill you up. Because if you're not doing the things that fill you up, why would you expect anybody else to help you do that? Or do it for you. So
exactly. I was trying to think back to what high school musical I was in. It was You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember. MASH was, so we didn't do musicals every year. Like MASH was the year that I got an award from the California State Secondary Association, California State Secondary Theater Association.
Nice.
So high school students in drama.
Sure,
I got an Excellence in Acting Award for MASH. And then we did Diary of Anne Frank. So yeah, we were kind of depressing. Our school plays
well,
were kind of different.
We did musicals 1 year and Shakespeare the next. And then we had, other plays because every season was like three shows. So I was usually involved in the other productions during the course of the year, but we only did two musicals while I was in high school because, again, every other year. And then we did two Shakespeare shows. And one of the Shakespeare shows we did was Taming of the Shrew. And
One
the
of my
other one was Romeo
favorites.
and Juliet. So, you know,
Oh,
we had fun, but we also hit some pretty hard subjects. So,
yeah.
you know, Nazis and Germany's, despite all the singing and dancing, it's still a pretty serious topic. So.
It was so this was like the 80s, the mid-80s, and the day before we opened Diary of Anne Frank, we opened up the stage so the people could see the set. It was really impressive. We had a ginormous Nazi flag as the backdrop. The entire backdrop was a Nazi flag, and it was just, I think we had a really good turnout
Oh.
because the set just blew people away. I
Yeah.
mean, how can high schoolers pull that off? Because it's all high schoolers who made it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You
Well,
know?
I think you have to give props to, you know, your director in a situation like that because, you know, I had a on again, off again, love hate relationship with our director, but he had a vision for how he wanted things to look and feel. And I remember my very first show with him as a freshman. We did I Never Saw Another Butterfly, which again, we're talking about Jewish concentration camps in Nazi Germany, right? So I remember him coming down the aisle yelling at me because I had flubbed my line and it was a rehearsal. And he's just like, no. And he's banging on the stage. And this is my first show with this guy. And I was pretty scared of him at this point. And he just recited the line to me. And I just turned 49 years old. I still remember it's meat, eggs, cheese, fish, poultry, fruit, jam, none of it for a Jew. I still remember that line. I can't remember any of my other lines from high school, but I remember that one. And it was because he had such a vision of an exacting vision of how he wanted things to look and feel. And his set designs for the little stage that we had were pretty amazing. You know, I have to give him credit for that, even if I do feel a little traumatized from my years under his direction.
I'm cracking myself up because, I have this little cough and this little sneeze thing going on right now. And so I went to mute myself and I didn't mute myself. So I'm sorry I coughed over you talking.
I was talking and I didn't even hear it. I was just
Oh
like, I'm
good.
gonna talk.
Oh good, because that's lovely. I love theater. Theater is one of my favorite things to talk about. I used to live in this town called Conroe, Texas, and Conroe has two highly competitive public, what are they called? Public, no. Public theaters, but
Community theaters.
community theaters, that's what I'm looking for. They are a block apart, but they're very competitive. And Conroe is about 60 miles north of Houston. Houston is the fourth largest theater district in the United States. So lots of good theater going on there, which means lots of competition, right?
Sure,
And
yeah.
so one year, our little tiny one of our local, community theaters did Chicago. And we had people from all over Texas audition to be in Chicago. And it was one of the best theater, plays I've ever seen in a, and it was this little tiny community theater with these highly very talented actors and actresses. And it's just like, wow, aren't we lucky?
I swear we must have like lived like parallel lives because I was in community theater before I left Michigan and we did Chicago. We were the first group in Michigan to get the rights to do Chicago. And we had same situation. We had people coming from all over the state to come audition because they wanted to have that role on their resume or whatever. And I'm like, this is community theater, you guys. It's okay. It's not, you know. And so one of those people did end up getting cast. And I mean, it was amazing. It was amazing to see how this different level of people who had norm, you know, we have our own core group that typically show up to our auditions. And then you have one new person come into the mix and change the dynamic. And then you know, she ended up bailing partway through the show. And it was like, what? So we had to find a replacement for her. Oh yeah, I know. It was theater. More theater, less drama, right? We had lots of drama. But I mean, the show still ended up being pretty amazing, and we were really pleased with the way it all turned out. So.
I find, and I have had this every single episode for the last like six episodes. I bring this up because it's true. There is always that one person in the group that everybody else follows. And sometimes that one person brings power and positivity, and sometimes that person brings negativity and just stagnation. So,
well, that's the whole idea of the strongest energy wins, mm-hmm. right? The strongest energy. It's why in a room full of women, if they spend enough time together, they will all start to match each other's cycle, and that cycle will be the person who had the strongest energy, right? We see that in business. We see that all over the place. The person with the strongest energy, the person with the most attachment, the person who, you know, stands with the most power and the strongest energy, because you can have power and no energy. But if you've got the strongest energy, you win, right? And that's not necessarily a good thing for the circle of people that you're traveling in. You know, if you want to ride roughshod over everybody and you've got the strongest energy, you're going to ride roughshod. But if you come with a heart of service and you come with an expectation of we're all in this together and you have the strongest energy, then everybody else rises to that challenge, to that level, and you see a completely different result. And I really believe, the first time I heard the strongest energy wins, I was like, yeah, whatever, that's more of that woo-woo stuff. But I've watched it play out time and time and time again in so many environments. And it's true, the strongest energy wins.
I want to ask you a question, and it's personal.
Please.
So I obviously have the strongest energy in the room most of the time. I don't know why, but I don't want to. I like to sit. I like to step back and wait for somebody else to step up. And inevitably, when I'm in the room, everybody waits for me to say yes. So how do I, if you were my coach,
sure,
what would you tell me to do?
Well, first thing first let me ask you some questions. One, does this happen in any room that you're in, or does this happen in rooms where the people in this space already know you, so they already have an expectation of who you are and what you're about?
Well, pretty much happens inevitably. So I don't, you know, whether or not I'm new to the group or not within,
okay.
You know.
Okay. Yeah. So there's a couple of things. And let me start with the first and most obvious one. We train people how to treat us based on two things: what they've come to expect from us and what we've come to accept from them. So if we're showing up in a space in a particular way and those people get to know us in that way, then every time we show up in that space, they're going to expect us to continue to perform and show up in that same way. And if we deviate, then everybody's like, what's going on? Like, who are you? What have you done? Right? Like, and we see this especially at the beginning of the new year. It's like, oh, New Year's resolutions, and I'm going to be a different person. And people are like, I don't know how to receive that, because you're making changes. You're rocking the boat. Now, that said, if you're in a new space where nobody knows you, then I would check body language, right? So if you're sitting in a space where you genuinely want to sit back and wait for what is everybody else going to do, then it's literally go sit in the back in a corner, pretend you're shy, pretend you're very introverted, keep your head down, and just kind of watch and wait. And I've been in this position, and it can be really challenging, especially for somebody who is extroverted or wants to jump in and help. We start to lean forward. We start to get excited. We start to lift our bodies. We cross our arms. You know, we start to demonstrate this strong energy in very subconscious, subtle ways. And people in the room pick up on that. They see your body start to tighten. They see you start to move forward. They're like, did you have something you wanted to add? And then you got to, oh, wait, no, I really want to see what's going to happen in the room before. And every time you're invited to offer, you have to defer. And that doesn't come easy for people like us. Right?
Yeah.
Because we want that invitation to jump in anyways. And so then it's like, oh, I'm excited about this thing. Let me go ahead and share. And as a coach, when I'm working and facilitating in groups, I've had to learn how to close my mouth, even when like I'm getting a divine download about this is a thing that needs to be said, but not until they're done and not until they're done. And yes, I have things I'd like to add, but I'm going to wait because I'd still like to hear from some other people in the room, right? And that's a way that you can direct your energy and not end up, quote unquote, in control of the dynamic of the room. I mean, you still kind of are because you've said, I want to see what everybody else says first, but they start to feel more like they have the latitude and the safety to be able to speak their mind. But if you come into a room with a reputation, it takes a little bit of training them to expect something different from you other than what your reputation has been when you come into.
So give me a suggestion on how to train people, because really it's about them not wanting to step up. And I mean, if you're listening, audience, if you're listening and you think I'm talking about you, please don't think I'm talking about you. I'm talking in very broad strokes.
Right. And part of the challenge of very broad strokes is, especially when I'm working with a client, I really like context. Context matters to me, because what you might do in one situation doesn't necessarily apply in another situation. But I'm always a fan of being honest, right? So here's the hard truth. Sometimes people don't want to step up because they don't want to step up, and it has nothing to do with you, right? They're not willing, they're not able, they don't feel safe, they've got too many questions, or it's just not their jam. There's nothing you can do in those situations to encourage those folks to step up. Now, if you're in an environment where stepping up is part of the game, i.e. you're coaching someone and you need them to step up or step forward, then you can make that part of the ground rules when you enter the space, right? You can set the terms of the engagement and say, look, I'm here to help in this way, and I want to be able to provide this kind of support, but you have to step up first. You have to say this, or you have to tell me this, or you have to be honest, right? One of the things that I tell all my clients is, I can't help you solve a problem if I don't know the truth of what's really going on. I need to know the whole picture, because I might make a suggestion that absolutely won't work for you because there's this other thing sitting out here that you haven't told me about, right? So if I don't know that, I can't solve for it. And I am a really good problem solver. I am really good at helping people figure out the how. You got a dream you want to achieve? Here's how we're going to get there. But if you've got a roadblock that you don't tell me about, then we can't go that way. Yeah. And I need to know that in order to move things around.
Well, that's now, true, not just in coaching, but in life in general. Anytime someone's trying to help you, if you're leaving out important information, they can't help you. You can't help yourself.
Right. And I will be honest and say, there are times when you don't know what you don't know. Yeah. Right? I didn't realize that was important. Cool. Well, now we know. So now let's shift gears, correct our course, and keep moving forward. But if you're withholding something really important, like, oh, hey, we need to make this investment in your business in this way, and you're sitting on $70,000 in debt that you didn't tell me about, well, we probably can't make that investment that way. We're going to have to do something different so that we're not creating more financial pressure for you. So I need to know that, right? Yeah. I've never in my life had... I think the hardest thing that I ever have to deal with when I'm working with clients is to get them to be honest about what their income situation is. You know, like, how much are you making? How much are you bringing in? How much are you keeping? How much are you spending? I hold no judgment around any of those answers. But if I don't have the truth of those answers, I can't give you a realistic approach to what's your next step. If you're trying to hold your cards close to your vest, look, we signed a contract. I promise you, I'm not going to go put your stuff on blast. I'm not going to tell everybody, oh, you only made $2,000 last year. I don't care. I want to know, you know, like on the treasure map or the mall map, X, you are now here. Like, I want to know where here is, so that if we want to go to the pretzel shop, we know the right path to get there that'll get us there the fastest. And if we don't want to go to the pretzel shop, we want to go over here, then I still need to know where we're starting so that we can move in that direction. And so for you, when you're in a situation where you really need that other person to step up, it is 100% okay to say, look, I have lots of ideas, I have lots of thoughts, but I really need you to do your part first. I really need you to show up first. I really need to see what you're going to bring to the table here, because otherwise I'm doing all the work. And I don't think that was the arrangement we originally agreed to.
Yeah.
So. Sorry, I got on my soapbox.
Let me sit down. you nailed it. And going back to the starting point, if you don't know your starting point, you can't set goals.
Right.
I mean, if you don't know a starting point, if you want to make $1 million a year, but you don't know where you are right now, how do you know how you need to get there? I mean, if you're at 900,000, you're so close, you don't have to do a lot of work. But if you're at $9, that's a lot more work.
Well, and you have to look at what is your realistic capacity to do that work, right? You can have a dream of a six-figure income doing this thing that you love. And if you've got an hour a week to give to it, it might take you longer to get to six figures than somebody who's got 40 hours a week to put into it. And so you have to be realistic. When you look at Sally, who, you know, did six figures in 6 minutes in her 6-week challenge or whatever, you don't have the same kind of resources to put into that. And if that's your reality, you need to be honest with yourself about that. About 30 to 40% of my clients come to the table with disabilities, chronic illnesses, capacity constraints that mean they can't work a 40-hour week. Okay, so what can you do? What is available to you, and how are you maximizing the available capacity that you have? I'm not telling you to quit watching Netflix. I'm saying that if you're choosing Netflix over this thing that you said you love, that's an interesting awareness, right? If you want to continue to put 9 hours into Netflix and 1 hour into your business, that's cool. But maybe 8 hours in Netflix and 2 hours into your business is going to help you really move the needle in ways that you didn't think were possible if you're willing and open to make those changes.
I have a story. I'm involved in a network marketing company, and that company has been around for exactly a year. And it launched in the United States a year ago. It hasn't even launched yet. It's in pre-launch right now. But, it opened its doors a year ago. And then in May, it opened in the UK, in the EU. And I'm going to call him out by first name. This dude, Wolfgang, joined the company. And he was the first person to reach the highest level in the comp plan. So he, and he did it in 3 months or something crazy like that.
Sure.
And I mean, so we're talking, I don't even remember what the comp plan is, but that's enormous. To reach the top level of a comp plan in a network marketing company is enormous, right?
Sure.
And so he's on stage, he's German, Wolfgang, he's German, obviously. So he's on stage at the pre-launch event in the United States, and I attended it. And he says that he spent 16 hours a day inviting people to an event so that he could have 500 people in the room. And that at the and then that event was a success. And then the next event, he continued 16 hours a day inviting people so that he could have 2,000 people in the room. If you want to get to the top of your comp plan in your network marketing company in 3 months, you got to spend 16 hours a day inviting people to events. I mean,
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
that's the so the I have absolutely no doubt that a person spending an hour a day on their business can get great results, but
Yep.
they're not going to be fast.
Nope. Nope. And sometimes fast isn't necessarily better, right? So I'll share my own network marketing tale. I was in a direct selling company years ago, and our regional director told us exactly how she managed to get 50 recruits in a month. And 50 recruits got her, like, she won the trip, she won all these awards, she got all this cash bonus, like the whole nine yards. And so we're all sitting there in bated breath. How did you do it? She's like, well, I ran ads in the paper for an opportunity event, and I held three opportunity events a week in four different towns for a month. And I think she got 52 people who signed up with her. And 30 days later, 30 of those people were gone. And 30 days after that, another 12 of those people were gone. So she went from 52 new recruits to like 18 in 2 months. But she got that cruise, she got that trip. And it's like, okay, yay you, but what have you done to those people? Right? Like, that's the reason why there are so many, that's one of the reasons why there are so many horror stories about network marketing and direct selling, is because there are people who see their goal and their target and what they've got to do to hit that thing, and they don't care who they step on in the process. And that was where I had a real disconnect with the industry as a whole, and was like, eh. And I was finding that a lot of people come to direct selling and network marketing as a starting point. They want to be a business owner, they want to own their own business, or they want to be a motivational speaker, or they want to stand on a stage and share their message. And network marketing is a ready-made place for them to get started because the products have already had their R&D done. There's already a demand for the product in the marketplace. They already know who the target market is. So all of the marketing research has been done. You just got to show up and build your sales skills. And so they start there and they build something. Sometimes they build something big and sometimes they don't. But that's not ever where they really wanted to end up in the first place. That was just their starting pad. And I, in the early days of me coaching direct sellers, started seeing more and more of those people wanting to leave, but not really having the business foundations underneath them to really go do something that they loved. And that's where I got my start as a business coach, was helping those people figure out what are the business aspects of running a business where you are the offer and your things are the offer instead of from some other company.
Well, I'm coming at it from the opposite end. So I started an internet-based business in the late 90s, along with my husband, and we created that business from the ground up. Nobody had ever done what we did, and we created the entire thing. 6 years later, people were copying us because we already had the formula in place, right? And that was a lot of work, a lot of long hours, a lot of sleepless nights, and I'm coming at it from, I have all this business knowledge now. I love my podcast. I love my coaching clients, but I also have, since I have the skill set in place and I see this product, this revolutionary product that's never been something that's never been done before, I can't imagine not doing it because I feel like it'd be stupid for me not to do it because I have the skill set, right? So, but I also know other, I mean, a friend of mine, she owned 50 restaurants. She used to own 50 restaurants. And she's doing this business with me because she knows that she has the skill set to do the work. So sometimes it's the opposite. Sometimes we're done doing our own thing and we're ready to just market. We're ready to just be, and then the most successful network marketers are exactly what you said. They're their own person, right? They show up, they're their product, right? I'm the product. I happen to have a line of things that I sell, but you're buying them from me.
I've always said from the very beginning that the most important product that your company has to offer is you. You're the only thing that's not in the catalog. You go to every event that every recruiting event, every sales event. You are the one product that is at everything. And you're the distinguishing factor because in a catalog, that 15 million consultants are using, to sell all of these items, you're the one thing that they can't get anywhere else. And that is really compelling for the right people, right? It's really compelling for the right people. And when you build a business on your own and you have scaled to a level where you've got an audience, it absolutely makes sense because you've already got a built-in audience to sell to, then network marketing or direct selling just becomes another offering in your list of things that you have for sale and available. And that's when network marketing or direct selling can be really helpful and powerful for you. And again, I still have the, and please treat people with kindness. And I know this isn't a thing for you, Candace, at all. I know it's not. But I've seen a lot of people, and you hear the horror stories about people who just take from their downlines and push on their downlines. And then their downlines are resentful, don't stick around, and it becomes really hard to maintain and cultivate your team. So that's
Well,
my one caveat on that.
it goes both ways though. Sometimes the downline expects you to do everything for them.
Oh, absolutely.
And you can't do it.
And
You
you
can't do
can,
everything for everybody.
no, you can't. And you can thank network marketing companies for that problem because the way they were built, sales training has to be done in, they have very specific parameters in order for independent contractors to stay independent contractors because of the federal government and the IRS regulations. So training has to be provided in a certain way. Everything has to be kind of mass, generic, general, which is great, but it's also problematic for the people who need some very specific instructions. So they start to expect, well, I'm going to get this free training from my company. Well, you're part of the company because you're my upline. So of course you're going to do stuff for me too. And it's like, no, that's not how this works. And that's where you start to hear the stories of, if you're going to invest in a business, you need to invest in yourself and you need to be willing to do that work. And you need to, maybe you need to hire a coach or maybe you need to invest in some business tools. And those are the things that the company can't say by law to their sales force, because then it becomes an advising relationship as an employee. And that's where that line of independent contractor employee gets blurred. So there's a lot of gray areas, and you need to go into network marketing with your eyes open when it comes to those kinds of things, because you are an independent contractor, but you still are beholden to whatever the rules and regulations are of your company that you've decided to join.
Yeah.
When I was looking at moving into the online space as a direct seller, this was before any of the companies had any rules about whether or not you could be online. The one rule they had was you can't sell on eBay. And I was like, okay, I'm not going to try and sell on eBay. I'm trying to build my own book of business, build my own email list, have my own website where I'm talking about my things. And I just happen to offer whatever my direct selling product is as part of that conversation. And I started to build an audience and people started to ask me what I was doing and how I was doing it. And that's how I created this whole different direction for me that took me away from direct sales and into the business coaching environment. But for me, it was always about build your business like a real business instead of an expensive hobby, whatever it is that you're doing, right? Whether that's direct selling or your side hustle or a hobby that you really love that you really want to monetize and turn into an income stream, you have to build it like a real business. You have to go into it understanding, at least on some level, the nature of profit and loss. You can't just keep plowing all the money that you get back into it because then you're not paying yourself, right? Like, you have to understand how all of that works at some level so that you can then grow and expand on that knowledge as a business owner, which, I mean, you know, because you built something from scratch from the ground up. I built one of the first ever e-commerce websites back in 1994, right? So you and I have that business acumen that a lot of people coming into network marketing don't necessarily have because they love the product or they love the person who brought them into the company or exposed them to the product. And so they're learning all of that stuff as they go. And you can't rely on your upline for everything. And a good upline leader trains their team to be good leaders so that they can lead themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're absolutely right. How did we get on this conversation about network marketing? Don't you love it? I want to talk
we
about
go around the world.
And I want to talk about unicorns.
Okay, let's talk about unicorns.
It's your word.
Yeah.
You know, so oh, well, okay, hold on. Let me back that up again. Since sure. For some reason, this is going to be about network marketing. I don't know why. this isn't a network marketing podcast. It's a, you know, it's a relationship marketing podcast, but I guess network marketing and relationship marketing, you are building relationships. If you're a good network marketer, you are good at building relationships.
Yeah. Right? If you do not have relationship skills, you will struggle the entire time you're in network marketing, because you have to be able to relate to your upline. You have to be able to relate to your leaders. You have to be able to relate to your downline. You have to be able to relate to your customers. And if you're not building customer relationships, you're not going to have enough revenue coming in to be able to sustain the business, right? Every yeah. business owner has to be able to maintain a relationship. So I totally am on board with that. Like, if you're not a good relationship builder, you're not going to be a successful network marketer.
Exactly. Exactly. So two things I want to talk about, and they're both unicorn related.
Sure.
So, okay. You know what happened before I even start this story? Give the definition of unicorn.
Well, when I talk about unicorns, I talk about a specific kind of unicorn. I talk about undiscovered or undervalued unicorns. And these are folks who are, pardon my language, damn good at what they do. And they've probably been at it for a long time. Think the therapist who's been in practice for 9 years, or the, you know, musician who has been playing for 30 years, right? So they're really good at what they do, and they have not achieved this level of recognition, respect, notoriety, industry acclaim that they deserve for as amazing as they are. So these are people who really stand out in the crowd to me, because it's like, why doesn't the world know who you are yet? Because you are just fantastic. And so when I talk about unicorns, those are the people that I'm talking about. Those are my people.
All right. So that's just about everybody.
Well, kind of, but not really. Because my subset is then again, creative entrepreneurs who are trying to monetize that gift, right? Like, I'm not necessarily talking to the world's greatest crocheter if they're not trying to become that celebrity in their space so that they're getting on all of the crafting stages and talking to people about creating crochet patterns or, you know, the latest designs or whatever. Like, that would not be a unicorn in my book, but they might still be a unicorn. They're just not an undiscovered or a undervalued unicorn.
Complete tangent. I am a crocheter, and several years ago, I started making my own sweaters. It was like I graduated from Afghans to my own clothing, right? Nice. So every year I make myself a sweater. And this year I'm designing the sweater as I go. I found a fabric that I like, a pattern that I like, and I'm turning it into a sweater. And it's frustrating. I mean, the arms are going to be way too big. The armholes are way too big. And it's turning out great, but the armholes are too big, and I'm having to deal with all that. I keep thinking, no way. There is no freaking way I would ever want to be a crochet designer, even though I know I can do it, because it's just, I don't have the passion for it, right? And so inevitably every year I'll go out in public in a sweater that I made, and someone will say, "Oh wow, you should sell those." And I'm like, I'd have to charge $1,000 for it. It's not, no, I'm not going to sell the things that I make. So there, it's okay. It's okay to have a hobby.
Yeah, you don't have to monetize everything that you enjoy or everything that you're good at. And I know, especially in this post-pandemic world where everybody is, quiet quit and moved on to other things and want to hang out their shingle and make $1 million doing something, it's okay to not do that with everything, right? Now there's a certain subset of us, fusion creatives, who have our hands in a lot of pies. We're good at a lot of things, we like to do a lot of things, and we're probably going to try and monetize more than one or two things, because that's just how we're wired. But that's not the majority of folks in the universe. If you've got something you love, it is totally okay to just keep doing it for yourself and for the folks around you that you would get a kick out of doing it for,
Because let me
right?
tell you, when you turn your craft into your career, it no longer becomes relaxing.
Yeah, it can very often become, a very frustrating, stressful situation. And I like to call to mind Elizabeth Gilbert's book, Big Magic. In the book, she tells the story, and I love to recount this because I think it's so affirming for creative entrepreneurs, especially folks who are, trying to do a side hustle or something. And she says she did not quit her day job as a waitress until Eat, Pray, Love became a bestseller and got a movie deal, right? She had already written four or five books before that. She was already making money as an author, but she had made the commitment to not put that kind of financial pressure on her craft. She was going to support herself with a day job until that craft could really take off and flourish and support her nicely, not have to struggle and not have to be like, oh my God, I got to get this book, because she didn't want that stress. She didn't want that pressure. So 5 books and a movie deal later, she went to the restaurant and was like, I'm giving you my 2 weeks. I am not going to be waiting tables anymore. And I think we have to give ourselves grace to say, yes, I love doing this thing. And yes, I want this to be my full-time make money career. And I'm not there yet, and that's okay. And I don't have to put all this pressure on. I gotta do it this way. And I gotta. It's not selling out to have a day job or a bridge job. In the 30 years that I've been online, there have been several times where I have had a quote unquote W-2 income, usually because I was consulting inside somebody's business, but I was, for all intents and purposes, an employee in their company while I was still coaching my other clients, right? That happens, and that's not something to be ashamed of. That's not something to be disappointed in yourself about, because here's the reality. Hey, nobody else paying your bills but you. And whatever it takes, as long as it's legal, if you're capable and able, then do that thing. Take the pressure off yourself so that you're not feeling like, oh my God, if I don't get this book done, I won't eat and I'll be homeless. Hello? Go find something else to tide you over. It's okay. It's better than okay. It's the right thing to do for yourself. Take care of yourself and take care of what you need. And don't expect that just because one person will offer you $100 for that thing you made, that now you've got this new income stream and you can sell them for $100 to everybody all the time, because that doesn't necessarily work either.
It's like a real estate agent who goes out and makes, sells a $1 million home and has this great income. What's a 3% of $1 million? What is that? $300,000? No, that's not right.
No,
Thirty thousand
30,000.
dollars. $30,000, right? So makes $30,000 by selling this $1 million home, and then thinks that they're just going to make $30,000 every month, and so adjusts their lifestyle before they actually know what their actual income is, and then never sells another $1 million home. Bad idea. I do. Yeah, I'm a little concerned. Because the culture here in the US, and this isn't, I have an international audience. So Canadians, I know that it's not quite the same where you are. I know this. But here in the US, we have this culture shift going on where people think that they're going to be able to quit their job and suddenly be making more money than they did in their career. And the thing is, there's a finite amount of money, and there's a finite amount of resources, and there's a finite amount of people who are going to want to buy the similar things. So unless you are, you know where I'm going with this.
You go ahead and finish your thought. I've got
also, eventually, you're going to want to have employees, right? So we can't just say all of us are going to be, you know, self-employed, because not everybody knows how to be self-employed. I mean, everybody still has to pay taxes.
Yeah. And I agree. Not everybody has the wherewithal to be self-employed. And I firmly believe that if a grown ass man can make a living unboxing action figures on YouTube, there is a market for the thing that you have. The question then is that market big enough to sustain you and the lifestyle that you want to live? If it is, then great, go for it. If it's not, then you're going to have to subsidize it with something else.
Yeah.
Right.
And if you want to be a grown ass man unboxing action figures on YouTube, and there is already somebody who is making a full-time living doing that, then your videos have to be 3 times to 100 times better than his videos.
I disagree with that. I don't think they have to be better. I think they have to be different and unique enough.
Okay.
That there's a compelling reason to watch you over watching him, or to watch you both, right? This is the same situation that we see with musicians. I can like jazz music and a lot of different jazz musicians, but if I've only got $40 to see one show, I have to decide which ticket I'm going to buy. Is it going to be that jazz musician or that jazz musician, right? That's opportunity cost. But if the songs only cost a dollar, I could spend $40 and get songs from all these folks, right?
Yeah.
So I don't necessarily think everything has to be exponentially better, better, better all the time, because then we're missing out on that long tail effect. And we're seeing a lot of long tail effect as people are leaving traditional employment to go out on their own. And I'm all for, hey, if you're making $10 an hour doing a job that's awful and it's sucking your soul away, and you genuinely believe that you've got something that is going to do much better in the marketplace than that job, set yourself up so that you can go do that thing, right? Set yourself up so that you can give yourself a try. But don't necessarily just abandon the job when you don't have anything lined up, if you don't want to deal with the consequences of not having a job and not having anything lined up, right?
Yeah.
There have been several times in my life where I was very close to homeless, and that was my choice. And I was willing to live with the consequence of, I'm going to have to sleep on somebody's couch for a month. I'm not going to have heat in my house for 4 days, right? Like, I'm not going to have this. And I'm okay with that for this period of time, because I know on the other side of that, this thing is going to be available to me. But if I didn't know that, and I had a 6-year-old or a 2-year-old or an 18-year-old living with me, then I would have to make different choices and endure a little more pain doing the job I don't like, so that I don't have to worry about them.
Yeah.
Right. So we all come to the table with different stories. We all come to the table with different capacity constraints and expectations around our time, energy, money, and resources. You have to be willing to live with the consequences of whatever it is that you've chosen to do, whether that's go out on your own or stay in a job or live with your folks or whatever, whatever, whatever. And I think too often, especially in our culture now, we're too short-sighted.
Yes.
Because we've got so much stress on us, we don't have the wherewithal to look that far ahead to see what the consequences might be. We're still trying to put out the fire that's right in front of our face.
Yeah.
And that's a problem.
You know, in the United States, I don't think we look back far enough, and I don't think we look forward far enough.
Agreed.
I think we live in a bubble, and there is so much going on outside that bubble.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that applies to a lot of countries, especially first world countries, right? Like, my husband and I were watching YouTube videos, and it was like the top 50 songs of like 1984 or something. And I was listening to some, I'm like, is this guy, the guy who put this video together, is he English? Because most of these bands are English and I've never heard of them, right? So, I mean, like, they've got a bubble of what was popular over there in the 80s that we were never exposed
to.
Well,
it's not just, you know, it's not just by country. My husband and I were in our car driving someplace, and I am singing the words to this song at the top of my lungs, and I know every single lyric, and my husband says, I've never heard this song before.
And, same.
And so, I'm from California, he's from Michigan, He listened to Motown and I listened to British New Wave.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
So I
Yep.
know all those British songs.
I bet you do. I bet you do. I'm like, I've never heard these because I grew up top 40, right? If it wasn't on the top 40, all I had was radio. I didn't have, growing up on welfare, you don't have a lot of extras. And so a
Yeah.
lot of music was not available to me unless it was on the radio. So if it wasn't top 40, I'm like, I've never even heard of this band. But that happens to us all across the spectrums of ways we build relationships, right? Since this is a relationship building podcast and that's what we're talking about here, we're gonna have pockets of knowledge that other people we're engaging with don't have. They're going to have pockets of knowledge that we don't have. And it's having those conversations that helps us bridge that gap and become more relational, right? My husband regularly shares some of that English New Wave because he knows those songs. I'm like, I never heard those. He grew up listening to that stuff because he loved it. And I'm like, I didn't have access to it. So he teaches me that stuff and I teach him other things. And we get closer because now we know each other better through the things that we're sharing with one another, right? So we can come to the table with our ignorance and be afraid of the things that we don't know, or we can come to the table with our ignorance and be curious about the things that we don't know so that we can start conversating with one another
Yeah.
and have deeper, more meaningful relationships that give us a broader look into who those people are that are sitting across the table from me,
Yeah,
which excites me.
I would rather be curious, because if I wasn't curious, I never would have discovered Middle Eastern food is freaking awesome.
Oh my God,
You
yes. That's the
know?
truth. That's the truth. That's the truth.
Never would have figured that. I mean, there's this thing that's made out of olive oil and garlic. Oh my God, it's called what is it called? I don't know. I don't remember what it's called, but it's like the most amazing thing ever. And I never would have known if I wasn't curious. So it's not just curiosity about food, but I'm curious about everything. I mean, I ask a lot of questions because I want to learn. I genuinely want to learn new things.
Yeah, and you're I don't want to say this and have it come off the wrong way. You're a special case, Candace.
Yes, I know.
Well,
I know.
the reality is there are a lot of people in this world who don't come to the table with curiosity, right? They're afraid of that person with a different skin color, or that person with a different ethnic background, or that person who comes from another town, or that person who's got ideas that are completely different than theirs. And that fear is oftentimes rooted in something that goes way, way back for them, whether that is programming from their families, genetic trauma. Like, there's lots of reasons why we bring that fear with us. But the fact remains, if we don't feel safe, if we don't feel safe, we stay in fear and we're looking for the things that are going to cause us problems so that we can avoid them like the plague, right? But if we feel at least safe enough and comfortable enough to crack the door, now we can be a little curious, but we can stay in our safe bubble most of the time. And that's the thing that has to happen so that we can break down those fear barriers and encourage more curiosity. Until people feel safe, until a person feels safe, it's really hard for them to be like, sure, let me go explore this thing that I know absolutely nothing about. That sounds like a real safe, fun time to me. No.
Yeah.
Right. So we have to go, come on, come on. We'll show you it's going to be okay. Here's a little glimpse. Here's a little peek. See, that wasn't so bad. Now we're going to open the doors a little bit wider. Maybe you'll even step across the threshold, right? Maybe you'll just take one little step and look around. Okay, cool. Now you want to come in. Now you can come in. Now you know you're safe, right?
Yeah.
That's what it takes. And we're not always willing to do that. And we don't always have the capacity to be available to do that, right? Especially in a culture where everything's coming at us so hard and so fast and we are so overwhelmed. It's like, I don't have time to take you by the hand and show you that it's safe. If you don't believe me that it's safe, get out because I ain't got time for you, right? And that leaves all those people still in their fear,
Yeah.
right? I mean, that's the reality of life. We can't all always rescue all the people around us and help them know that they're safe, but we can do it with one person. And we can do it with another person. And those are the relationships that beget new relationships that continue that conversation and open up more people to be more curious as time goes on.
Well, and that's the important thing, is how do we make people feel safe when they're with us? Right? Do
Right.
people feel
Ripples
safe
in a
with
pond.
us? And then can we teach them to feel safe with the other people that feel safe with us?
Right.
And then can we teach them to feel safe with the people who feel safe with them? And just that the ripples go on and on.
Ripples in a
Because
pond,
you are
yes.
absolutely right. It is fear. is what has gotten us to where we are today.
Mm-hmm.
And love isn't necessarily going to get us out of it, because people love to be afraid. But
yeah, that's true.
But safe, helping people feel safe is how we get out of it. So you nailed that. Yeah. You nailed that. It doesn't matter if we're talking about business, politics, or whatnot. You nailed it. Safety. Yep. Safety first. All right. We were going to talk about unicorns. Oh my goodness gracious. We don't have much time to talk about unicorns. I want to circle back to network marketing, because I was going to tell a story and I didn't get a chance to tell it, but this is a good place to end, because you specialize in helping people become the rock star in their space.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's my jam. Yeah.
So I have noticed after I started in network marketing when I was 18. I mean, when I was 18, I started a Tupperware business. So I've always been involved in some sort of direct sales, network marketing, multi-level marketing business. And I recently discovered that there are a lot of people who don't like the word marketing and don't understand the word marketing. So I think my vocabulary is going to go back to direct sales. I'm just going to use direct sales to encapsulate every type of business in that genre, in that sphere.
Yep.
And some people don't like selling, but you understand sales better than you understand marketing.
Sure.
So some people understand sales better than they understand marketing. Where was I going with this? Anyway, I have noticed that inevitably in any of these companies, there's always a rock star who emerges, or five rock stars, or there's rock stars within their little regions. I've noticed that a lot of times, sometimes it's not true, but a lot of times the rock star is the person who's most willing to help other people.
Yeah.
So talk about that.
Yeah. So one of the things that I'm not even going to tell this story. I'm going to tell the story of Taylor Swift. So her first manager was Rick Barker, and I met him once, and he's an interesting dude. But one of the things that he said on this day that I met him that really stuck with me was he had told Taylor, if you want to sell 500,000 records, you got to meet 500,000 people. Like, you've got to do the work of shaking those hands and saying hello and being friendly and staying after your shows and signing autographs and all of that stuff, so that you are endearing yourself to those people. Now, the good news was for Taylor, that came naturally, because she's naturally a friendly, kind person. So I'm not saying this to make it a gimmick or to make it a ploy, but the reality is, if you want to step into the spotlight, you have to be willing to build those kinds of relationships, even the loose ties relationships of meeting people, saying hi to people, helping people out, showing up for them when they need you, and being a friend to them, right? Now, being a friend to them could simply be saying happy birthday on their birthday, right? There's different levels of friendship. But these parasocial relationships that we have in the online world, where everybody feels like they know you because they've been watching your Instagram feed for 2 years, right? It's that, but it's also, hey, when you're in my circle, like you're on my team in a direct sales business and you need something, you can reach out to me. Now, you also have to put some guardrails around that, right? Because nobody is going to respect a pushover. You don't become a rock star by being a pushover. You have to have clear boundaries. My hours are from 6 to 3, or my hours are from 5 to 9, and you can reach me anytime on Mondays, or send me an email if you need this, right? I can help you in this way, but I can't help you in this way. If you want this, you have to do that, right? One of the best lines I ever got from a direct sales leader was, I will match your efforts. So whatever you do, I will match with you. If you sell, you know, if you book 4 parties, I will provide you resources to make sure that your 4 parties are going to be successful. If you show up to the meetings, I'm going to show up to coaching calls with you. If you're not showing up, I'm not showing up. Don't expect something from me if you're not willing to do the requisite amount to earn or be in the space where that magic is happening, right? So when we want to rise, whether it's in direct selling or in our family, you know, status, or in, you know, our jobs or in our friendships, we have to be willing to open ourselves up to a little bit of vulnerability and share pieces of ourselves. The other day I was watching a video and who was the guy who did who's the guy who, Trevor Noah, that's who it was. Trevor Noah said, I think our friends are like our Horcruxes. Like we leave a little piece of ourselves with them, you know, every time we're engaging with them. And we have to think about how we're investing ourselves in our fans, in our followers, in our supporters, in our downlines, in our team members. If we're not willing to put that little droplet in them, why should we ever expect them to lift us up and hold us in the level of esteem and respect that we're wanting as the celebrity in our space? Like we have to be willing to make that investment first, or they're not going to make that investment back in us. It's that old, you know, that old axiom from Zig Ziglar, you know, nobody cares what you know until they know that you care. And we have to be willing to do that. Now, again, boundaries, because we're not doormats and we're not pushovers. But again, we have to be willing to accept the consequences of, I want to have these people in my life. I want them to be part of my team. I want them to be my fans and supporters. So I have to be willing to do this much to meet them where they're at and be in relationship with them. So
Sorry, I have a visitor.
that's an adorable visitor.
I don't know what his deal is. He's, well, I know what his deal is. Our daughter went back to grad school and he misses her.
Aww.
So he needs attention. This, so those of you who haven't met him, this is Shade.
Aww.
Okay, so you're all of that spot on. I love Trevor Noah. So anytime anybody talks about Trevor Noah on the show, I'm like, oh, maybe I need to put him on my list of people that I'd love to interview.
Yeah.
Because right now I've at this point in time, I have interviewed everybody on my list of people I wanted to interview, except for Neil deGrasse Tyson. So now I'm adding Trevor Noah to that list. So
There
my
you
list of
go.
people I want to interview is Trevor Noah and Neil deGrasse Tyson. Audience, if you know either of them, hook me up.
Nice.
Okay, so we need to wrap up because we are way over time. So what is your favorite marketing tool to protect technique?
Oh, my favorite marketing technique is to be yourself, warts, sparkles, and all. Like when you show up authentically as yourself, you are attracting the right people into your universe and you are repelling the wrong people. And it is a technique, but it isn't a technique. That's what makes it so easy.
Excellent. Okay, so Lisa Robin Young, this is your moment of gratitude. For whom or what are you most grateful?
Oh my gosh. I am really grateful for my husband. He has been going through a lot in the last few months. He had major surgery and there's some weird stuff going on with his job, and he has just been a rock for me through all of it when he doesn't have to be, right? Like it's his turn to be cared for and I'm doing my part, but he just keeps showing up and really being there for me. Like I just had my birthday and you know, he got me a present. I was like, we weren't doing that this year. You know, and he's my person. And I can't be more thankful for anybody on this planet than him.
We are both Capricorns. Happy birthday. My birthday's in a few days. So
Oh, happy early birthday.
I
Yeah.
knew there was a reason why I liked you. I always get along great with Capricorns.
Same.
I don't know. I think, yeah, same. Anyway, all right. We're done. So thanks for tuning in to Gratitude Geek, the relationship marketing podcast for micropreneurs, building genuine, lasting relationships with clients, colleagues, and community. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on Audible, iTunes, Good Pods, or your preferred podcast player. Our theme music is Track 14 by Rev Rock and Solali. Make sure to visit gratitudegeek.com for all the groovy ways to connect with our guest, Lisa Robin Young. I've been your host, Candice Rinardi. Stay groovy, my friends.
Stay groovy, my friends.